I would like to welcome all of you to this session. This is one of a series of events that CSIS has been convening on avian influenza, both the nature of the virus and also its medical, economic, and security implications. As you know, experts at WHO and elsewhere believe that the world is now closer to another influenza pandemic than it has been any time since 1968. That was the time of the last of the previous century's three pandemics. This H5N1 influenza virus is a new virus subtype to which the world's population does not have immunity. As you know, it's not yet spreading efficiently and sustainably among humans, but medical experts believe the threat is extremely serious. Our speakers today will address the economic and financial implications of a pandemic, with the caveat that much depends on factors for which there is much uncertainty, both about the evolution of the virus and our response to it. So that said, I would like to introduce our speakers. I'm going to introduce all of them, and then there'll be questions and answers after the first two speakers and at the end of the session. Our first speaker is Donald Marin. Dr. Marin is the acting director of the Congressional Budget Office. Our second speaker is Don Hanna, who is the global head, emerging markets, economic and market analysis at Citigroup. He came down from New York today. Thank you, Don, for doing that in this weather. Dennis Carroll is the senior infectious disease advisor and director, Avian and Human Influenza Response Unit at USAID. We commonly say that the avian influenza has not yet developed into a pandemic. We talk about its potential impact, but in fact, the impact on the poor in Southeast Asia and elsewhere who've had to slaughter their poultry on which their families depend, the impact has been quite serious. Andrew Burns is a lead economist at the World Bank Prospects Group, and Charles Blitzer is the Assistant Director, International Capital Markets Department at the International Monetary Fund. Donald, you're on.
Great. Thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. I hope you'll forgive me for being someone who hasn't yet joined the PowerPoint revolution, and I will just speak without images. It's a pleasure to be here today. Happy to represent the Congressional Budget Office, an organization I'm very fond of in the, 8 months that I've been able to be there. As you know, what CBO does is we provide advice to Congress on a wide variety of topics. We score and analyze bills. And then in addition, in essence, we answer questions that our clients bring to us. And one of the questions that was brought to us was the question about what would be the potential impacts on the U.S. economy of a possible avian flu pandemic that we might see in coming years. I should note, just from CBO's point of view, this was an interesting project. This was not something that we'd worked on previously. This involved some very impressive work internally by our folks getting down the learning curve on the science aspects of it. If you think of CBO, the first thing you should think about is economists and policy experts, and we do have some scientists and some former scientists, but mostly the economic front. So you're going to get little doses here along as sort of how good economists talk about science. And if I get anything that's not exactly positively correct, blame those two over there. We will correct it as I go along. The original request came from Senator Frist, the Majority Leader of the Senate, in roughly the middle of last year, and we issued our first report on this topic in December. That puts us relatively early in the literature on the macroeconomic effects of an avian flu pandemic. So at the time we were doing that first study, we didn't have many other things to go on. There are a few studies out there about the effect of SARS that we saw a few years ago. Since then, I'm happy to say that there's been a growing literature on this topic, and I'll try to include at the end of my remarks a few remarks about what that literature has sort of taught us and how we think about our study in light of that. Let me start with the basic facts, as Anne referred to. So we have the H5N1 virus. It's widespread in poultry, has been widespread in poultry for a long time. First known human cases, at least that we're aware of, were in 1997. And there's been relatively little evidence thus far of human-to-human transmission of it, although there are a few examples of that. The pandemic concern obviously comes from the fact that, A, this is not a virus that we or people generally have been exposed to in the past and built up in immunity. So at some sense, we're sitting ducks, for a poor pun. It's something where if it made the transition to easy human-to-human transmissibility, then it would have the potential to be a pandemic that would spread around the world. Now, starting point for our thinking about this was to first try to get a handle on the likelihood that such a pandemic would actually come to pass. We obviously sort of took two approaches to this, right? We asked people and we looked at history. On the asking people side, our folks talked to a variety of scientists, epidemiologists, public health experts to get a sense about what they thought about predicting the likelihood of a pandemic. And it turns out that basically we weren't able to pin anyone down. It's extremely difficult to predict possible future mutations in a virus. While it's possible to think about mutations and directions that things might change, it's very difficult to predict which ones kind of the natural selective process will actually choose to come to occur and when it would occur. And so from the science side, the sense is that it's quite difficult to predict when and if a pandemic from H5N1 may actually occur. If you go and look at history and try to get a sense about the frequency of pandemics in the past, the first place you would obviously look is at the last century, at the 20th century. As probably you're all aware, we had three flu pandemics during that time period. In 1918, a very, very severe one killed many people, and milder ones in 1957 and 1968. Now, if you were just sort of a very crude frequentist and you looked at that century, you would say, wow, it looks like we get these pandemics about once every 35 years, and then about one out of three of them look like they're severe. And so that might be a starting point for thinking about kind of the likelihood of these things occurring. It turns out, however, that there are data sources that go back further in time. There are people who've tried to study the frequency of pandemics in previous centuries. As you might imagine, the data become weaker and weaker as you go back further, but there seems to be reasonable evidence back to about 1700. If you go back to 1700, so a little more than 300 years, you find that there are roughly 10, somewhere between 10 and 13 pandemics during that time period, which again is kind of right in line with the once every 35 years, you know, once every 25 to 40, somewhere in their kind of range for the frequency historically of pandemics. And if you look for severe ones, it turns out the 1918 stands alone, and that a very severe pandemic of the 1918 style seems to be quite an anomaly, quite unusual over the last 300 years. And so, again, those data would suggest to you that you're talking about something that, on average, is going to happen somewhere every 25 to 40 years if the future looks like the past, right? And all the usual mutual fund warnings apply, right? You know, past performance may not be a guide to the future, but, you know, it's instructive. And you take that all together, and that suggests that if you knew nothing else, you would say, wow, there certainly is a possibility of a pandemic developing, but it isn't something that you would necessarily say is going to happen in a year or 2 years. It may take time. And furthermore, it may be difficult to predict what it actually turns out to be. Right? It's entirely possible that H5N1 doesn't turn out to be the thing that gets us and something else that we're missing at the moment does. Okay, so significant uncertainty on the when and if. Now leaving that aside and moving to sort of, well, what would be the impacts if it came to pass? You know, the first thing for us to look at to get a handle on this is, again, the science side of it about essentially what are the impacts on the population, how many people get sick, how many people die. In terms of benchmarking our scenarios for a macro analysis, we decided to focus on the 20th century, to take the 1918 case as essentially a severe case, since it appears to be the most severe flu pandemic that we've had in recent centuries, and take 57 and 68 as essentially being mild cases. And so we'll talk through two scenarios that will then drive what our estimates of the possible macroeconomic impacts would be. Let's start with 1918. In 1918, let me look across all three. If you look across all three of the pandemics in the 20th century, it looks like somewhere between 25 and 30% of the population becomes ill at some point during the pandemic. Okay, so that'll be a starting point. You're talking about a quarter to a third of the population generally becoming sick. And then what fraction of those die? In 1918, it was 2.5%. So the case fatality rate, right, conditional on becoming sick, you had a 2.5% chance of dying. If you look at 1957, 1968, significantly lower. It was more in the neighborhood of about a tenth of a percent, a little bit higher. Okay, so a difference of roughly a factor of 25. I should note that 1918 was special in other ways as well. Frequently, flu pandemics have the attribute that the populations that bear the brunt of it tend to be the young and the old. And so you see higher elevated fatality rates among those populations and less elevated fatality rates among people who are sort of prime age. In 1918, it was quite different. Actually, the older folks did better than average, and the kind of prime age folks did worse than average. There are a couple of hypotheses we've heard on why that might be true. One possibility is that the older age folks actually had been exposed many decades earlier to a previous close variant of the virus, and therefore had built up some immunity that kept with them so that when it came back around again, they didn't fall as sick. And another hypothesis is that one way that the flu basically cause damage to your body was elevating your immune response, that people with less sort of, you know, immune response ready to go would be less affected. And again, that would be something that would affect the prime age folks more. That's not something that we took into account in our scenarios. In essence, our scenarios are going to assume that the flu outbreak treats all populations equally. But something to keep in mind as you go along is that that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. And you can imagine a flu outbreak that systematically hits working age people harder or less hard than the average people. Okay, put that all together. As I said, we're going to do our two scenarios. Population of the United States is about 300 million today. So for our severe case, we're going to assume that 30% of those become sick. So that's about 90 million people come down with the flu. And 2.5% of them die, which is roughly 2 million deaths. For the milder case, we have a quarter of the population become sick. So that's somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 million. And of those, in the neighborhood of 100,000 become sick. 100,000 die. Put that in some context, it's useful to benchmark about once what we experience today when we have the seasonal flu. Seasonal flu, rough orders of magnitude, kills about 40,000 people a year in the United States. And so the mild scenario would be about 2.5 times as bad as that, and the severe case would be about 50 times as bad as that in terms of the number of deaths. Now, again, these figures are based on looking at history, looking at the 20th century, and in particular for the severe case, looking at 1918. There are a variety of changes that have happened since then that might lead you to believe that the actual effects today for a pandemic would be either higher or lower. On the lower side, reasons that things might be better today, we obviously have better medical care, certainly than 1918. We have both better antibacterial treatments that can be used to treat secondary infections, and we have better antivirals that can help people survive if they become exposed to the virus. We have better surveillance, right, a better idea of what's going on around the world so that we can prepare in advance if a pandemic develops. And there's at least the potential, depending on the timeline and how good our surveillance is and how good our technology is, of possibly developing a vaccine in time that even if it's not available at the beginning of the pandemic, for the, sort of the later waves of it, there may be a vaccine that is, we're able to deploy and give some people protection from the virus. Okay, those are all reasons why the effects might be lower than they've been in the past. On the other hand, reasons it might be higher. Right, we live in a very interconnected world. People can travel the world quickly. It's possible that diseases will spread more rapidly than they did in the 20th century. And we also have a larger population of folks who have compromised immune systems. Both a larger share of the population, both in the United States and globally, is elderly. And we have larger populations of folks with AIDS and similar diseases that suppress their immune systems. That may increase the potential impact of a pandemic. Now, you will notice that the examples I've drawn from history have fatality rates conditional on getting sick, that the high case is 2.5% and the low case is about 0.1%. If you open up your newspaper and you read about the data we have thus far from the avian flu exposures, the ratio looks more like 50%. So rough orders of magnitude, 200-plus people diagnosed with the illness and somewhere north of 100 of them have passed away. There's quite a mismatch between that and what we've seen historically with the flu pandemics that have actually come to pass. There are essentially two hypotheses that would bring those numbers kind of into congruence and make them consistent with one another. The first is a classic data collection issue, that in a world where not everyone is tested for this disease and it's still a relatively new disease, you may miss a lot of the cases and you may be much better at actually finding the cases where people die than the cases where people survive. And so as a result, the measured case fatality rate at the moment may be biased high, in essence, relative to what is actually happening but not observed. And then the second issue that you often hear discussion about is whether something that's that lethal could actually succeed in being a pandemic. Okay, and so there's a hypothesis that, in essence, in order to be a successful pandemic and run around the Earth, you need to be less virulent so that basically each person who gets infected does a better job of passing it on before they die. Either of those theories would lead you in the direction that the case fatality rate of a possible avian flu pandemic would be lower. For myself, I can't speak to the science of those. Perhaps other people on the panel or in the room can. Again, for us, we're mostly driven by looking back at history. Right? And history suggests that the flu pandemics that have actually occurred have case fatality rates that are much, much lower, right? Where the severe case is just 2.5%, not just, that's a lot, but it's 2.5%, much, much lower than what we've observed thus far in the measured data on the avian flu. Okay. Now I need to insert my economist's all-purpose warning label, which is we're talking about human beings getting sick and dying. This is a very bad thing. It is much worse than measures of GDP at all will ever tell you. Nonetheless, the question that was posed to us is what would be the effect on GDP? And I'm not going to give away too much if I say that at the end of the day, the effect on GDP would be somewhere between moderate and small. which is not to downplay the risks at all, not to downplay the value of the human life and the suffering, just to say that for henceforward here, that's going to be outside our scope. And the main question that we were asked is what's going to be the effect on the economy, because obviously that's important both for the economy and from our clients' point of view. It's important for things like how much tax revenues do you get, you know, how's the government doing, what's spending look like, those kinds of things. So turning to the economic side, I would say that our goal going in was that if we were going to make an error, we wanted to make an error on the high side. Right? So we didn't want to accidentally miss something that could be an enormous shock to the economy, conditional on the assumptions we made about exposures and fatalities. And so when in doubt, probably our assumptions went in the direction of getting a higher economic effect than a lower one. As I said, we looked at two scenarios, a severe one and a mild one. And in both cases, we essentially looked at the potential macroeconomic effects as coming from two directions. Okay, there's the supply side, which in essence goes through the labor market. If people become sick and stay home, if people stay home because they're afraid or they have to care for their children, or if people become sick and they die, all of those folks will be out of the labor force for some period. The people who die are out of the labor force permanently, obviously. And the people who become sick or the people who stay home to care for, what we assume is that people who become sick will stay home for 3 weeks on average. And that's some combination of staying home because you're sick or staying home to take care of loved ones. That's going to give you a supply-side effect in that all the various productive parts of the economy are going to have fewer workers, and as a result, you're going to have less output. Tracking that through in our severe case, we estimate that in essence you'd lose about 3% just on the supply side over the course of a year. Right, might not all fall on a single calendar year, but spread over the year during which a wave of the pandemic may go by, you'd lose about 3% of U.S. GDP in the severe case, and you'd lose about 1% in the mild case. Okay, and that's just, you know, straight up fewer people going to work, therefore less stuff, less services produced in the economy. On the other side, there's also going to be a demand shock. Right? And the demand shock, first, obviously, sort of, you know, the obvious demand shock is that there'd be a peak in demand for medical services, and you'd get some boost to the overall economy from more people going to the doctor. Again, like I said, this is, you know, we're focusing on GDP. That's not necessarily a good thing, but from a GDP accounting point of view, that gives you some boost. But our expectation is that would be more than offset from the fact that people basically want to pull back on their consumption and their demand for various kinds of products. And then in particular, they're going to cut back on their demand for products that involve exposing themselves to people. Right. So, for example, the think tank conference market would take an enormous hit in this framework if there were an avian flu pandemic. Now, we might all do it by telecommuting and, you know, TV cameras and whatever, but this kind of event would probably pass away for a few months. And what we did is, in essence, we made some bold assumptions about what that would look like in fields like entertainment, recreation, lodging, etc., and assumed, you know, significant drawdowns in those for extended periods of time as people were afraid to go out and afraid to do that kind of consumption. Smaller drawdown in demand for things like retail trade, which then flows through to smaller demand for things in wholesale trade and other sectors of the economy, basically is just as people ratchet back their demand. Take those all together, and in the severe scenario that we had, those added up to about 2% of GDP, and in the mild scenario, those added up to about 0.5% of GDP. And so then you added together our two scenarios, and we basically bracketed it by saying that in the mild state of the world, with a mild pandemic, under these assumptions, you would have a macroeconomic impact that was somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.5% of GDP in the mild. And the way you should think about that is that the U.S. economy, left to its own devices, wants to grow at the moment around 3%, maybe a little bit faster. And 1.5% would take you then from roughly 3 to roughly 1.5. And so that would be a slowdown, but probably wouldn't cross the line into being perceived as a recession. And given the other things that happen in the economy, it's something that may or may not be easy to observe as it happens. In the severe case, right, where we estimate that there'd be a 5% reduction in U.S. GDP, that's something that's more noticeable. Right? Again, if the U.S. economy wants to grow roughly 3-ish, maybe a little bit higher, 3.5, and you're hitting it with minus 5, you're talking about growth actually being negative in that year. And so in the severe scenario, you'd have something that looks like a recession, probably, you know, more severe than average recession, certainly more severe than the last two recessions we've experienced in this economy, and certainly something that would be noticeable and blamable on the outbreak of the pandemic. Now, again, I want to emphasize that, you know, when in doubt, we erred a little bit on the high side on these estimates, and there are reasons to think that these potential numbers could be lower. Now, I should step back and say, just to give a little perspective, it turns out since 2001 that CBO has developed a new line of business. And the new line of business is, in essence, analyzing the effect of disasters, either after the fact or prospectively. And so after the fact, we've analyzed, obviously, 9/11. We've analyzed Katrina. Prospectively, we've analyzed the potential impact, macroeconomic impacts of an attack on a port, something that would disrupt trade into the United States. And we've analyzed prospectively, happily, the potential impacts of an avian flu pandemic. I would say from the ones that involve the analysis looking backward and seeing what actually happened in the past, I would say a recurring theme in those kinds of analyses is that the effects that actually happen on the economy tend to be lower than you would have thought in advance. And that the reason is that sort of, the standard economist message is that people are good at adjusting, people are creative at adjusting, and that if you have a flexible economy, people will find ways to adjust their behavior. You see a similar thing actually at the moment in the last couple of years also in people's reaction to higher energy prices. If you asked any economist, you went back to any economist 4 years ago and said, what would happen if oil prices went up to $70 a barrel? They would have said, wow, the U.S. would have a severe recession. And in fact, that's not what's happened. And a significant part of the reason why is that we've developed an economy that's actually quite good at responding to shocks and being resilient. And frankly, it's difficult doing forward-looking analyses to fully incorporate such resilience into our models. And I think that's one reason why I think that our results probably tend towards a little bit the high side on the avian flu effects. If we had done similar things, say, for Katrina or for higher oil prices or for 9/11, I think at the time we might have estimated higher effects than actually came to pass. Now, there's been a growing literature on this topic, and it's this will not surprise you. It falls in three camps. There are people who get estimates that look pretty much like the CBO estimates. There are people who are higher, and there are people who are lower. While I'm very fond, obviously, of the people who get similar results, turns out many of them often sort of built on our model, and it isn't actually that surprising they ended up in a similar place. I want to emphasize in particular one study that finds lower effects, because if you think about the strategies you can use for estimating these effects, you can sort of take the CBO perspective, which is in essence, let's figure out what happens to the people, and then let's use our knowledge about how the economy works to estimate the macroeconomic impacts of that. And along the way, we'll have to make some bold assumptions. And along the way, we can do a little bit of benchmarking to things like what we observed in the SARS outbreak, but there's a limit to how much we know. There's one study which was done by some folks, I believe, for the Canadian Treasury, where what they do is they go back and they actually look at 1918. And they ask what on earth actually happened to the economies, in this case of Canada, and also of parts of the United States at that time. And as you might imagine, the economic data from 1918 are nowhere near as comprehensive and good as the economic data we have today. But the data that they're able to find suggests that, in fact, people knew that the pandemic was going on. So they checked. First thing they did was check the newspapers and confirm that it wasn't a surprise to people. People were aware of this. It wasn't necessarily on the front page, since there was something else going on in 1918, World War I, that was getting a lot of attention, but certainly something that people were aware of. But then nonetheless, to the extent that there are data available from retail sales or from looking at people who ride the subways or those kinds of data, it appears that people, by and large, went about their daily lives. And that as a result, looking at all those sorts of evidence, they estimate that a severe pandemic would have an effect more like our mild case, so somewhere in the 1.5% range of GDP. And then a mild case would be even smaller, 0.5% of GDP, something in that area. So recommend that study to you as sort of the alternative approach to try to estimate these effects and also an interesting exercise in what you can tease out of historical data from a period that's almost 100 years ago. Ooh, 2 minutes. Good. I'm right on schedule. So I guess just to summarize, so CBO, again, our client is the Congress. The Congress's question to us was, in essence, what are the potential impacts of these, potential pandemics that might actually come to pass. Our strategy was to basically take a lot of information from history, assume that future pandemics would look like what we've had in history. That turns out to give us a severe case and a mild case. Track through those potential impacts, probably a little bit on the high side, and find that it looks like either sort of a small growth recession, to use a phrase not often used these days, but kind of a slowdown, but still significant economic growth, or possibly something that trips us over into recession. But if people are sufficiently sort of resilient and flexible in adjusting to those shocks, the effects could be smaller. Should also emphasize that particularly, actually on both supply and demand side, to a significant extent, the macroeconomic impacts are going to be driven by policy choices and by the reactions of ourselves and other people. Right? These are primarily going to be or significantly be driven by decisions about if you're not sick, should you go to work? And if you're not sick, should you go consume? And those are things that will be driven by sort of the public reaction to this, which is difficult to forecast. And will also be influenced, obviously, by some policy decisions, whether local governments close schools, those sorts of things. There's also some room for policy decisions at the federal government to impact what the macroeconomic impacts would be. The easiest example to give would be the development and encouragement of the development of vaccines that might be used. To the extent it's possible to develop technologies and capacity to produce vaccines rapidly once a pandemic breaks out, there becomes, as I said earlier, the potential to get that vaccine deployed by the later stages of a pandemic and thereby to reduce the potential both human costs and economic costs of a pandemic in those later time periods. With that, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me just put these pictures on the screen for just a second, if I can find the right part of the page. There it is. Okay. Well, thanks. I'm going to start, as I said, what I'd like to do is you're getting the dual Dons or Donalds here. I'm going to try and compliment my namesake by talking a little bit about some of the economics, as well as some of the financial market aspects, given my role in a leading financial institution. I'm going to start with a little geography. Part of what concerns the issues that surround H5N1 is simply the fact that you have the virus, avian influenza viruses, influenza A viruses, are generally in birds, and birds fly. And that is one of the issues associated with concerns that arise out of this virus is simply the flight patterns, which luckily in this last winter we actually haven't had yet outbreaks in the Americas. But we have, as you see, the spread of the disease across wide swaths of the rest of the world, originating, most people think, in China, as many other influenza A viruses have in the past. And the difficulty that creates is as the virus itself becomes endemic, then this whole process of mutation becomes, since there are simply more, the virus is more extant, there's more likelihood that it comes in contact with a person, which allows for interaction that would create a virus that could, in fact, become easily communicable, number one. And number two, since there's more of it around, just the natural mutation of the virus itself could mean that it figures out the way to pick the lock that would allow it to get into human cells and become infectious easily across people. Now, as an economist, that's about all I know on the epidemiology. But what I wanted to focus on, is some of the economic channels which were just mentioned by Donald. He mentioned the supply shocks, the lost labor inputs. There's also reduced efficiency. A little bit of personal history. I until last November, actually lived in Hong Kong for the previous 11 years. And so when SARS hit in March of 2003, I actually spent about 7 weeks on the road. That was essentially because I was lucky enough to have left Hong Kong shortly after the virus hit, and people would actually see me, or at least many people would see me. Some people still wanted to talk to me on the phone. But, of course, associated with that distancing that comes from the fact that people are concerned that if they get up close to you, shake your hand, breathe on you, you're going to die, leads to a situation in which there are obviously increases in costs that are independent simply of the fact that fewer people come to work. Or in an influenza virus, depending on its mortality, that there are, in fact, fewer people to work. All right. And in fact, some of the models that are out there show that is, in fact, one of the most significant costs that the economies bear, those rise in costs. And that's particularly important because it bears on whether or not one should expect from a pandemic that you get a rise in inflation or a fall in inflation. Right? Because the other effect you've got going on is the demand effect, right? As Donald mentioned, we wouldn't be sitting here talking, and in fact, April and May, a lot of conferences were canceled. In fact, the Asian Development Bank conference was canceled, right? It was postponed and done, I guess, about 4 months later when SARS was over. So that demand shock, obviously, is a decline in activity. And I'll show you a chart in a minute which shows you that, in fact, SARS overall was really just a disinflationary shock. Prices went down because people continued to work. Why? Partly because the transmission mechanism, the communicability of the disease was far lower than it would be for most, for what people think would come from flu. So it's the mix between the supply and demand shock that's going to matter for what happens to inflation. That's going to matter for what happens to interest rates. Yeah? And that's going to make a big difference also for what happens in bond markets and in equity markets. Okay. The other factor that's important in trying to think through the economic and particularly the financial market effects is what a degree of panic is associated with an influenza virus outbreak, a pandemic. In SARS, it was quite serious, partly because there was grave uncertainty about exactly what was happening. Initially, no one knew what created the virus that was creating the problem, didn't know whether you could communicate it if you were asymptomatic, yeah? Didn't really know how to treat it. In fact, Hong Kong had very high levels of mortality associated with SARS, and there's now some doctors saying, you know what, it was partly the way that they treated the patients that may have actually exacerbated the disease and its problems. So that sense of uncertainty generated certainly a lot of the initial interactions or the social distancing that went on, as well as the implications that we saw in stock markets across Asia, in Hong Kong, Singapore, and Taiwan, which were very heavily affected. I think the final point was one that Donald also brought up, which is a sense that how governments respond, and particularly how central banks respond, as well as governments in terms of spending respond, will matter for the kind of interaction that we get in terms, again, of variables like inflation, interest rates, exchange rates. one final point. Well, let me show you the picture here in terms of SARS. This is actually a... The chart here is showing you the inflation rates for across Asia aggregated, and this is there's two of them here. They're core inflation rates. So I'm trying to strip away what might have been happening with oil prices or food. And if you look at that that drop, you see I don't have a pointer, but it's just above the July 03 numbers. You can see that things drop down dramatically. The other spikes are essentially what happens at Chinese New Year, which is a big fluctuations in countries in Asia. But you can see you get a big drop down that only lasts for a couple of months. That's essentially the effect of declining demand, right, with supply staying more or less constant, that you got from SARS in 2003. Here's some figures that I had put together actually about a year and a half ago when we were trying to estimate some figures on bird flu losses, very simply not as from a human pandemic, but rather just the costs associated with SARS in part also looking at the losses that you simply have from the poultry sector, which I think Dennis will talk about in a little while here. And you can see the what's shown in these figures are the declines in the growth rates associated with that. Now, there are actually aggregate numbers. Donald mentioned different studies. I've put up his figures as well as those from done by a man named Warwick McKibben and a colleague at the Lowy Institute, which is in Sydney, which has the advantage of having done numbers globally as well as for the U.S. And there's an interesting set of numbers here. You notice that, for example, with the U.S., the figures between that Warwick put together and those from the CBO are very close, as are the World Bank numbers, which may not be the numbers that Dennis will show me. These were taken from some work that was on the web. I think it was done last November, December, I believe. In essence, what's interesting about the Lowy Institute numbers, for example, is that they're much higher for the rest of the world, and particularly for Asia, than they are for the U.S. And one of the things to take away from that you don't get from looking at individual country studies, and which is important for financial markets, is that in this global model that Warwick McKibben runs, you actually have effects on financial flows that are a reflection of how sensitive or how vulnerable particular countries are to the effects of flu. Okay, in essence, the United States is relatively better positioned to deal with flu, in part because of essentially because of better healthcare standards, being wealthier, and that essentially allows for lower mortality levels. Yeah. And a relative, as far as financial markets are concerned, a relative safe haven effect that drives monies that are concerned about in the panic that might be associated with this, at least initially, monies to flow from very hard hit areas, which are principally in Asia. Now, Warwick makes the assumption that the disease breaks out in Asia, which is the standard assumption, so take that with a grain of salt. But nonetheless, we have these capital flows that go to the United States and tend to lower, strengthen the U.S. dollar and lower U.S. interest rates, which then tends to cushion the effects that we have in the economy, okay? Because you get less of an effect on investment than you otherwise would have. So that, I think, is something to keep in mind. Now, the other point about Warwick's study is he has supply effects that are very large, yeah? In fact, if there's actually a dichotomy breaking down the U.S. number that's shown in the severe case is 5.5%. Actually, about almost 5% of that is simply the effects associated with labor losses. Oh, thank you. It's about 5% of that is associated with labor supply, which is only about 1%, and about 4% of it is increased costs. Yeah? Now, that is, it turns out, and a lot of that has to do with the incidence of mortality, et cetera. But if you alter the mix of the switch between the demand effect, which he only has at about 1% for the U.S., and the supply, you can actually get different outcomes, as I said, for inflation and for rates, and that's important. Let me slip through here, too. This is simply a chart from the report that I was involved in, which looks at, again, talks about some of the uncertainties that surround the nature of the pandemic. If you want to know the financial effects, just as you need to know the economic effects, depends on whether you've got a 1968 variety or you have a 1918 variety of flu. Yeah? And the central difference is, if this is temporary and relatively mild, what's going to tend to happen is that the panic effect will dominate in the beginning, which will depress asset prices, people will adjust, and because there isn't a lasting effect, because there will have been an overestimation at the personal level, as I did when SARS hit, everyone thinks, oh my gosh, I need to protect myself. Activities are ratcheted back very much more than the actual risk one runs. And because of the uncertainty surrounding what risk you actually do run, that then leads, as you figure that out over time, you get the rebound. And as a result, then you get a much different pattern of financial asset performance. And hence, that's the blue box on the bottom here. I get to use this. As opposed to what would happen if you actually had the severe case and serious mortality and cost increases, that would dramatic. One of the things that would be associated with that, as far as the equity market is concerned, is that if you were in an environment in which you did have a serious loss of the labor force, actually, you would tend to have the marginal product of capital would tend to go down, and with that, so too would long-term interest rates would tend to go down, but so too would the value of stocks. Okay, and so you would actually have some lasting effect from the effects of a more severe pandemic. Again, obviously the issues that surrounding the financial market effects depend again on global supply and demand. You want to try and essentially focus as far as financial assets are concerned on those activities in the services sector that allow you to do things without coming in contact with others. Right? In New York City, where I now live, Fresh Direct, which is a company that delivers groceries to your door with you never seeing the person, great business for a pandemic. Right? All kinds of telecom, video conferencing. On the other hand, we're going to have even more airlines in bankruptcy if that's possible. Yeah. you get any kind of labor-intensive industries would have difficulties. Electronics, interestingly, could have some problems because if this is, in fact, Asia-centered, yeah, because we have such an integrated supply chain that requires international trade through various countries within Asia, although a lot of that is still concentrating in China, you can have disruptions to that supply chain that create problems that are more serious. And, of course, for all of these telecoms and companies, they're to actually be benefiting from that. There's the assumption that the magnitude of the absenteeism or the labor shock associated with the virus is not so severe as to compromise the actual operation of those levels. I know many companies like ours have beefed up the activities for off-site or remote operations that stemmed out of September 11th in anticipation of disruptions such as this that would ensure that in fact the basic underlying systems occur. Couple of other points that I wanted to bring up in thinking about how exposed one should be. I'm just going to skip to the end on this. One of the things I did in this report was think about what are the various avenues that would, if capital flows are going to be dependent essentially on how exposed one is there a simple way of putting together some measure of sensitivity? There's a simple way and there's a complicated way. I've done a relatively simple way, which is to look at things like, well, right, if this is a disease that is developing rurally in birds, yeah, well, how important is the rural economy in your economy? That will have some effect. What's population density? Yeah, that's going to have some effect in terms of the transmittance. How many visitors do you have in a year as a share of your population? That's also going to have a difference. I can show you some of the charts right here. For example, if I look at my former city of residence, Hong Kong, tourist arrivals over the course of the year are 16% of the residents of Hong Kong. Okay, whereas places like India, extremely low. Yeah. Now people still come and go, and depending again, this is where the question of whether the disease would spread asymptomatically becomes critical. Yeah. In SARS, one of the things that occurred was, turns out you had to be symptomatic to shed the virus. So the country set up and still have infrared screens in the airport. So you walk through, and if you turn red, the doctor says, sure, the attendants there pull you aside, and you can't come in until they figure out what the issue is, why you have the fever. It wouldn't work, right? So if, in fact, the virus flu would be transmissible without being symptomatic, in which case you would have probably more severe effects on transportation than, in fact, we had from SARS, or at least they would be more long-lasting, okay? You've got healthcare expenditures. Again, there's no real surprises in here. I've also looked at sensitivities of the population, depending again on where the incidence of the virus would hit. Would it hit if it's like a typical flu? It's the young and the old rather than the working age. So these numbers are in there as well. And the final thing I would want to mention in terms of sensitivity has to do with government responsiveness. And here I've taken some figures that are put together by colleagues of Andrew Burns at the World Bank on government effectiveness. Okay. And this has things like how effective government regulation is, what the levels of corruption are, yeah, how effective the rule of law is and its enforcement. And you can see essentially that, and if I were to think about the countries in Asia, government effectiveness, if it comes to questions of quarantine, for example, or being able, or simply responsiveness to the conditions, are critical to, in fact, how vulnerable or the ultimate effects would be, as well as the policy responses that I mentioned earlier. And so if I put these all together just simply, you can see this ranking that more or less looks like GDP, but with some differences in terms of where countries would rank in terms of sensitivities. And, of course, one of the concerns that we have now, at least I have, is that you have a spread of the H5N1 into Africa, which on these measures of government effectiveness or sensitivity show up very high in terms of sensitivity, and hence the potential for both the difficulties in monitoring the existence of the virus in birds and controlling it at the source, which is one of the hopes in terms of trying to limit the effects, becomes itself more complicated. I'll stop there and we'll, I think, go to questions for Don and Don.
Okay, we have about 5 or 10 minutes for some questions. And Marty Apple.
I'm Martin Apple, Council of Scientific Society Presidents. You said you couldn't find very many scientists that could give you anything to pin down the risks and the probability of spreading and all this. Most of the scientists that report in peer-reviewed magazines and journals seem to have that as a pretty high and threatening thing that's hanging over them. So I don't understand the gap between what you could find and what has been published in the science literature. Second question focuses really on the issue of the percent of lethality that you're looking at. You're making a comparison to a period of time in America in which people were traveling by horseback, and you're now in a completely different travel mode. And I can't understand how you can make this match. Can you tell me what the lethality was in the early cases of the pandemic flu in 1918 and how they compare to the early cases now?
Does that work? So on the, let's see, the first question was, I'm already losing my short-term memory.
Why won't somebody say it's going to happen?
So there's certainly a lot of concern, and a lot of concern that's been expressed, but when phrased with the question, what probability would you put on the pandemic occurring in, say, the next year, at least the folks our team talked to were reluctant to give us a number, right? I mean, there's clearly the generalized sense of concern. There may be specific estimates out there, but that was not, there wasn't anything in there that made us think that, we were left thinking that history is still quite an interesting guide on this.
What you're saying is that they didn't think there was no risk, but they couldn't pin down the time.
Yes.
Yes.
That's very different than I thought I heard you express. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. You're good at this, Ron.
I was going to say, the epidemiologist we talked to said it's a question of when, not if. In other words, that a pandemic will occur, but because of the uncertainties about the mutation process, we don't know precisely when, but it will occur, and hence efforts at trying to reduce vulnerabilities are crucial.
Casually explaining that.
All right, horses. Well, again, I mean, our study is based on appeals to history as a starting point for this. 300-plus years of the history of pandemics, best data available, obviously gets worse as you go back further in time. And the outlier, the high one, is the 2.5%.
Okay. A lot of uncertainty on these issues.
Could I just follow up on that, if I might?
Sure.
There is, if you look... some of the literature on the Spanish flu has higher levels of mortality, right, that range, I think, up to 5%. The work that Warwick McKibben did makes some assumptions that, again, are predicated essentially on 1918 with a higher incidence of mortality in the older ages. And that, too, gives you mortality rates that go up, in fact, above 5%. But, again, the question of what the mortality of the virus would actually be depends on what virus becomes ultimately communicable, and part of that is it a recombination with an existing human flu, or is it simply a mutation which might change essentially the immune response that the human body would have, and hence the mortality?
To come in on that as well. I'm obviously not a scientist either, but we have some epidemiologists at the bank and who are looking at these issues. And what they tell me is very consistent with what Don just said, is that essentially the disease is not at this point, or H5N1 is not a candidate for a pandemic per se. It has to change. It can change in one of two ways. And one way is, and this is why it's so important to try and restrain it now, is that somebody who currently has a normal human flu also catches H5N1. Okay. Now the two genes combine and we get something new, which takes some of the characteristics of the existing human and some of the characteristics of the avian influenza. Now, what is clear, if you think about that, is that new disease is different from the avian influenza and is not going already, if somebody's got that other human flu that it's combining with, there's some immunity in the population and the deadliness of it is likely to decline. And then I guess the other issue that is critical in trying to think of what it's going to, its ultimate effect is whether or not the eventually transmissible pandemic flu is of a type that generates what, now I always get this wrong, a cytonic storm or
cytokinic
storm. That's my dyslexia coming in, which is what they feel happened in the case of the Spanish flu, and that's essentially this immune response that floods the lungs with liquids, and very healthy people end up dying. And that's those are among these uncertainties which make our job very uncertain. Sorry.
Okay. Can I add something too, Ann?
Sure.
We've talked about this particular issue at some length with the avian flu experts at WHO, who made two points. One, there's good theoretical reasons why when these viruses mutate and through a transformation, they lose their mortality. And there's also historical experience to back that that theory up. So, pardon?
It drops 20-fold.
It's a different disease when it mutates. It's not the same disease anymore. And just finally, just a bit of fact, I did see that there was cross-country variance in the mortality in 1918, and the incidence of mortality in Fiji was about 20%.
Okay. Another question, right here in the middle.
Joseph Dudley, SAIC. Your last slide, Don Hanna, it was very interesting because I kind of lost count, but in terms of the...
You can put it back up.
The H5N1, please, would you? Sure. In poultry... has already occurred in the top 14 countries, 15 countries on this list.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a single one missing.
That's how I.
That's basically because I constructed the slide for those countries in which we have it already there. So it's not a it's not the entire universe of countries, but essentially what I wanted to make was the point that we have it in level in places which seem which are very exposed. Whoops. Sorry. Too fast with my fingers. But we'll just do it the simple way.
This report is available on the CSIS website as well.
Yeah, unfortunately, so your point is absolutely correct. But there are places which don't yet have it where for example, there's nowhere in Latin America that's shown here. If I were to do these numbers for a place like Haiti or Bolivia, the numbers would be equally high.
So the United States is and Singapore are the only two on there where this hasn't showed up in poultry yet.
Yeah, well, Singapore has zero agriculture, right? Essentially, Singaporean agriculture is in Malaysia.
Nipah virus ended up there from the pigs.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, the Singaporeans have closed the borders actually a couple of times because of the outbreak in Malaysia. Sorry, there's a question in the back, I guess. There's several questions.
Hi, John Taylor from Congressman Petri's office. I was wondering if I could ask the gentleman from the CBO, have you guys taken into account anything about just-in-time supply chains and how the U.S. economy might be more vulnerable because of that?
So for the supply side, the primary driver of it is the effect on labor. And
There's a subtle issue about how you assume the impact of changes in the number of people showing up for work translates into an effect on the economy. Dramatically oversimplified, in my line of work, the stuff that we produce at CBO is a combination of labor plus capital, where capital is primarily computers. And there's one model of the economy in which if no one shows up to use the computer, then neither the person produces anything nor the computer produces anything. And there's another model of the economy in which, in essence, if the person doesn't show up, other people use the computer instead, just less effectively. We adopted the first assumption that I gave, which is, in essence, that when people drop off, the capital they usually use isn't used as well because this is a short-term shock. And that has the effect of, in part, not explicitly accounting for the specific effect you identify, but it has the effect of incorporating an effect that there are some inefficiencies that in essence happen around the economy.
Let me just comment that some of the future sessions we have planned in this series will look at the impact of a pandemic on critical infrastructure sectors, IT. Transportation, other critical infrastructures, and we'll address this question as well, the supply chain impact. Steve Evan.
I'm Steve Evan. What happens when somebody doesn't show up for work in China? And what happens to the U.S. economy when labor is severely affected in other supplying countries?
Our model doesn't incorporate a great deal of international trade effects as a channel for this impact occurring. The CBO folks over there will remember who it is. There are some people who've done that study where they've, in essence, they've tried to add on to our study some additional impacts from changes in trade, and you guys can nod your heads. My sense was it didn't add that much.
It depends what you assume. A lot of the studies that come up with very large economic effects.
Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the work that we've done, which I'll present a little bit later, indeed does incorporate those kinds of trade effects. And I think the story that you're hearing here, the reality is it's not probably a valid thought experiment to ask what would happen if there's a pandemic in China but not in the United States. The science of this with air travel is that once it starts somewhere, it's pretty much everywhere very quickly. And as a result, what dominates the results that we're generating is not the trade linkages. They're important and they have an impact, but rather both the labor market effect and the kind of behavioral impacts that we've been talking about already.
Okay, we're going to have to go on to we have the pleasure of going on to our next speakers.
Where are the files, sir?
They're sitting on the desktop.
Yeah.
Andrew first.
Here we are. No, that's not mine. Go back. Here we are. Yeah, the shortcut's not working.
Do you have the flash drive that was on?
Yeah.
Flash drive.
Yeah.
Why don't you have some more questions for us?
Are there other questions that we will ask while Dennis gets the presentation up?
In the
back, who had his hand up. He hadn't asked a question before.
My name is Jeffrey Milstein, and my question with regard to both the models is the degree to which both have done sensitivity analysis to important assumptions, which obviously can affect the outcomes of the results. For example, public health effectiveness. Arguably, the U.S. Public Health Service was actually stronger in 1918 than it is today. The government responsiveness in the Katrina episode would give us pause as to assuming a certain degree of effectiveness, for example, of government response that may not actually be there when the reality hits. So my question really is, to what extent did both of the models incorporate sensitivity analysis to look at alternative assumptions of this sort?
Well, so obviously the main sensitivity analysis in our setup is by doing the two scenarios, so that you have the difference in terms of how many people exposed, in particular how many people die. And, you know, obviously sort of somewhat bold assumptions about how people react to that on the demand side. The model is certainly set up so that one could include different assumptions about how people respond, particularly in our simple macro framework. Most of that effect would show up in the amount of time that people are out of work, or possibly sort of indirectly in the degree to which people are, you know, concerned about going out to the malls and whatnot. We don't have sort of specific public health parameter in there. It's more kind of, you know, more 30,000 feet macro parameters. You know, you could certainly run it with different assumptions on those. I mean, again, for our purposes, sort of the main was just kind of drawing out these two stories, and with the main sensitivity being the comparison of the two. But that's something in principle you could do.
I guess I just comment that in terms of the variance one could have in effectiveness as opposed to simply money spent on healthcare, it probably gets swamped by the degree of uncertainty we have surrounding what the virus would actually look like and how what its mortality would be with the best possible healthcare intervention, right? And so as a result, the sort of the questions around how effective healthcare systems are, probably given the range of uncertainty we're dealing with, doesn't feed in. Not to say that one shouldn't try to improve the standards of public health, but rather that it just gets swamped in the other uncertainties that we have in these forecasts. The other comment I'd make is, to the extent that the dealing with the pandemic involves some level of quarantine, for example, and there is a collective action problem here, right, which is that individually everybody wants to separate themselves, and separating themselves often means going from populous areas to unpopulous areas, right, which helps the transmission of the disease. Interestingly, when we looked at what happened with SARS, places where the government was more forceful, in Singapore, for example, relative to Hong Kong, were actually in some ways more effective at enforcing the quarantine, because they basically said, look, they were better able to deal with the collective action problem. And they were more willing to use government force at an earlier stage in the process. And so, interestingly, this whole question of government effectiveness in part stems on how willing you are to put the dynamics of the disease over the dynamics of individual preference.
Let's. I'll bring a pause to the questions now and move on. Move from the sort of the 30,000 foot level that Donald was talking about, certainly the macroeconomic, and talk more about
household economics and looking at the impact to the extent that we understand what the impact of avian influenza is and could be at household levels. And the link between the rearing of poultry and poverty. Really, there are three levels of presentation I'd like to talk about, though. First is the household economics of avian influenza and use one particular study that was done in Vietnam. But then to link this sort of analysis and, as the subtitle of this presentation, The Chicken That Lays the Golden Egg, is to talk about the double-edged sword associated with the economic benefits associated as an incentive for poultry rearing and how that, in fact, is contributing to this not if but when, not which pathogen or virus, but at what point will a new pathogen or virus emerge. So the evolving rapid dynamics of this evolution of mutating viruses out there and to what extent household economics, to some extent, are facilitating and enabling that. And then lastly, end on a note of simply focusing on sort of the emergency or the protective response, increasing access to vaccines, increasing access to antivirals, will in no way prevent the emergence of a new pandemic. And all of the economic scenarios that you've rolled out here are talking about what are the consequences for what will be wave after wave of pandemics. And as we will see, we're looking at probably increased frequency of those events happening, moving beyond the 35 to 40 year breaks that we've seen over the past 300 years. General observations. Over the last year, there have been about 4,000 avian influenza outbreaks among poultry that have been reported to the World Animal Health Organization, or OIE. And of those outbreaks worldwide, 75% of those, plus or minus, have largely been in mom-and-pop small farmholders, largely unregulated backyard farms. These small farm holders largely represent the lowest social economic quintile, so that there's a driving economic force which is enabling or encouraging them to rear these poultry in the first place. And lastly, the poultry farming, beyond the economics and livelihood, also represent an extraordinarily important nutritional, supplementary nutritional asset. With that said, specifically with respect to Vietnam, and this is a study that was largely done by FAO and the Pro-Poor Livestock Initiative, but looking at Vietnam over the last year, half of all households, rural and urban, keep chickens. And in rural areas, that is about 7 out of 10 households, or 8 million total, own chickens. And these flocks average about 16 birds. And we can see their hens, cocks, growers, and chicks for the aficionados here. But that only 1% of the flocks consist of more than 100 birds. So we're looking at most of the poultry that is being reared in these settings are among very small farm holders. On the economic side, we see that these smallholders largely have a per capita income of less than $100 US per annum, and a flock of 12 hens yield a month of income of around $18 US through the sale of eggs and birds, and that based on an initial investment of $2.50 for the purchase of a hen, we're looking at and an additional estimated 65 cents for what is referred to as the fraction of a cock, the annual return on capital investment is about 700%, an enormous contribution, again, to the lower social economic. In addition to the high rate of return, though, we see that a further advantage that these households have with respect to these investments is the flexibility to partition their investments in small amounts over the course of the year as needed. So not only does it bring in much-needed income and provide much-needed nutritional supplemental resource, but it's also providing the flexibility to use these resources over the course of a year. At a national level, if we were to extrapolate then back over all of the 8 million rural and urban households that have these small farms, we're looking at about $550 million US per year are generated in Vietnam on the basis of these small farmholders, which represents about 5% of agricultural GDP. If there was an impact on these rural holders, and they had diminished access to their ability to rear these poultry, largely having to do either with the direct result of infection from H5N1 or the culling response associated with attempts to contain the virus. It would translate into about 2 million full-time jobs at 2.5 million full-time jobs at minimum rural wages essentially being lost. One can then, while these studies haven't been done, one can then imagine that extrapolated over the geographic area where the 4,000 outbreaks were recorded worldwide, that we're likely to see, again, looking at the similar social economic profiles and economic status of the different groups that are involved, you're likely to see similar incentives for populations to make investments for purposes of rearing poultry on a small mom-and-pop scale. So the conclusion, and this is the first conclusion I just want to sort of focus on, and is that there is great economic efficiency in these added sort of economic assets. And so as we consider from a program or a response perspective in attempts to contain avian influenza, certainly in countries like Vietnam or elsewhere, there's an economic cost that has to be considered as well as a nutritional cost. But there's a second conclusion, which isn't as obvious, and that is because of these extreme high rate of returns for the low economic quintiles, we're looking at, over the last several decades, an explosion in the number of households which have taken the step to enter into small backyard farming. By way of example, the China syndrome. In 1969, estimated 750 million people living in China, there were an estimated 50 million backyard poultry being reared. But by 1999, population of about 1.2 billion, the population of poultry had increased to 15 billion. One of the consequences, however, of the movement towards the increased poultry rearing is that these were largely done, again, largely in backyard or small farm holders, but more importantly, they were largely done in a way which was consistent with traditional farming practices, which enables or contributes to a high risk of exposure to populations for any viruses which may be resident in those poultry. For example, these next two slides are just showing what those traditional backyard farms, or in this case, traditional marketplaces look like, but a place where you see an enormous amount of interaction between poultry and an enormous interaction that you see between people, and as a consequence, increased risk of transmission of what are avian viruses to populations. This all goes back to the issue about, does this mean that there's a greater risk of a pandemic flu occurring? And just to remind you, there are three requirements for a pandemic flu. That one, it be a novel virus, that it have the ability to replicate in humans, and that it had the ability to transmit efficiently between humans and humans. In the case of H5N1, we see that two out of these three criteria are clearly established. What we've seen over the last 20 years is about from the onset of HIV/AIDS all the way up to 2004 with avian influenza identification, we've seen about a dozen new pathogens which have emerged, creating new risks to human health. And we see that these are largely worldwide in their spread, but there's a tremendous focus in the high population areas in Asia. One of the consequences of this is that even as we move forward to try and build an immediate response to H5N1, and as we've seen in the appropriations which have been made available over the last year within the United States government, in excess of $7 billion. This is largely focused on two areas. They're focused on emergency response at the international level as an attempt to contain and isolate the movement of this virus, and an attempt to build new generations of vaccine development, which makes it more timely and available for the event of any future pandemics, and the development of new antivirals. But what none of these resources do is address the underlying cause, which is giving rise to new generations of potential pathogens and potential pandemic flu candidates that are emerging out of this high level of interaction between people and poultry. And so one of the issues that we need to keep in mind is that all of the resources that are going now towards responding to H5N1, while they are extraordinarily important and they demand to be applied in the ways that they've been proposed, they will not be sufficient to stop the emergence of any new pandemic and or reduce the threat of that pandemic from occurring. What is likely to happen, however, is that we will see the emergence of new vaccines, new drug therapies, again being drugs and vaccines which will circulate easily within the first and second world, but will not make themselves available to the third world. And as we've seen with diseases like tuberculosis, malaria, and HIV/AIDS, that we are potentially, with a singular focus on creating a protective bubble around our own interests, looking at the potential that we will be looking at future pandemic outbreaks being largely consigned to the peoples of poverty, and we will be seeing a marginalization of what pandemic flus will, what impact they will have in terms of us, but not diminishing the enormous health risk, and as we talked about the potential impact on Africa or other third world regions, the economic consequences there. So the good news with respect to household economics with respect to avian or poultry is that there is a real economic incentive. The bad news that this economic incentive is enabling increased exposure and increased probability that we will see increasing rates of new emergent threats with respect to pandemic flus. And unless we get at the animal husbandry and the traditional practices which create this cauldron of interaction between viruses, animals, and people, then we will not be able to respond effectively in the long term, and we will be continually being asked what the economic, microeconomic, or macroeconomic consequences of pandemics will be, but not really being able to have a significant impact on the emergence of new pandemic threats. Thank you.
Trust me. I'm the most untrustworthy person. Great. Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure being here. We'll see what happens in the presentation. I think we've covered a lot of the ground that already, and but maybe there's an opportunity to go into a little more depth on some of the issues that we have before us. What I'd really like to do is basically leave you with three main points. The first really goes a little bit to what Don was saying. Don, everybody's Don except for Dennis. that Dennis was saying that I'd like to talk first of all about the bird-to-bird component of avian influenza and then talk about the human pandemic. And I think that the point that I want to make concerning, and this goes really to what Dennis was talking about, that as concerns bird-to-bird flu, while it's a very serious problem for the rural poor, and there I agree with everything he's saying, its macroeconomic effects are actually relatively small. And so that we do have to recognize that focusing in on those the poverty impacts and those very microeconomic impacts of bird-to-bird flu is very important, even if at the macroeconomic level it's something that's easy to lose sight of. The second is that the economic consequences of a human pandemic, should one emerge, are likely to be very dependent both on the severity of the disease, but also, and I think that's something that we've alluded to, on the, what as an economist we call an endogenous reaction, the endogenous behavioral reaction of people to the disease. is there a panic? Do people stop shopping? Is there no travel? And that really is an important driver, and it's an important issue for policymakers to think about and attempt to determine what steps they can take in order to minimize that impact and thereby minimize the economic impact. So basically the final point is just the policy response. Policy's got to focus on reducing the likelihood of a pandemic, and that's indeed what it's been doing with some success. Educating the public to avoid costly overreactions, and that we're really talking about speaking clearly to the population. And finally, strengthening human and animal health systems. And I think we're making progress on all three of those levels. We've had a little bit about the history to date. We've got a bird-to-bird flu that began in 1997, but between 2003 and 2005, has been limited to about 10 countries, most seriously Vietnam, Thailand, China, Indonesia. Over the last 6 to 9 months, really something more recent, it's gone global, spread to some 40 countries. It's spread both by wild birds, and that's what we've seen in the European spread, but also increasingly we're seeing it coming through the trade channel, through domesticated birds that are infected being shipped to another country and infecting birds in that country. So the disease and the transmission mechanisms are getting a little more complicated. So far we've got about 200 million domesticated birds killed either because of the disease or in an effort to prevent it. That's about 1.3% of the stock of birds at any given point in time. One important thing to recognize in here is that these birds reproduce relatively quickly, and so even if you were to eliminate all of the birds in a country but provide them with eggs in order which to reproduce, that would only reduce production in that sector by about a third. So basically you've got a turnover in the bird population of about four times in a given year. How big is the poultry sector? How big an impact is this having for developing countries? Well, I'll try to go to that in this graph. You can see it's small everywhere. We're talking about a maximum of a 1.4% of GDP in South Asia. That's taking the value added both in the sort of raw poultry sector but also the processed food sector together. And it averages less than 1% for the world as a whole. But it's an important agricultural sector, and I think Dennis was pointing that out. It represents 30% of world meat supplies, 9% of world protein supplies. Surprisingly to me, it was certainly surprising to me, the United States chicken represents the largest source of protein in the United States as a share of anywhere else in the world. So this is a real important issue for the American diet going forward. It has important secondary effects as well. I mean, 20 to 25% of world maize corn production goes to feed chickens. And so there are secondary effects that are important resulting from this disease throughout the world. I think it's pretty clear, or maybe it isn't clear, but so far we've had a little limited impact on GDP from the disease, even in the countries where it's been most concentrated. But it's a big impact on the poultry sector. 20% decline in poultry production in Vietnam, 80% decline in poultry sales in Romania. Anecdotally, I was talking to a Romanian colleague, and she was saying that she had a friend who was in the pheasant export business, and the poor guy was stuck with freezers and freezers and freezers full of pheasants and no market for it, nowhere to sell, couldn't do anything. And these are small but very real impacts that this is having. Equally surprising in a country like France, where there's a very small and isolated, two actually small and isolated outbreaks, there's been a 40% decline in poultry-related incomes as a result of that. And that's really going to some of these psychological and behavioral effects, or the demand side effects that we described in the previous presentations, having much more of an economic impact than the disease itself here, just in the bird-to-bird thing. Globally, The FAO, the World Agricultural Organization, predicts it's going to be an 8% decline in world demand for poultry products this year, all basically as a result of fear, which largely is without foundation because cooked chicken has no risk of transmitting the disease. But that's the world we live in. If we look at the specific example of Thailand here, which is the yellow line, you can see there was a 40% decline in Thai exports following the outbreak and recognition of it occurring. The pickup that we see in 2005 reflects a switching among Thai producers saying, well, okay, we're not able to export uncooked chicken, so they're moving to exporting cooked chicken in an effort to get back into the market. And that's working. And that goes, I think, some to the flexibility issues that Don was talking about. The reality is the market does react. People do react to these change situations, and that tends to reduce the long-term impact. So in many of the studies that we're talking about the economic impacts, we're talking about the short-term economic impact. In the long run, after actors and agents are able to adapt, basically the bird flu becomes a little bit like HIV or anything else. It's something we learn to live with. We'd be happier if we didn't have it, but you're not looking at a permanent necessary disruption to the global economy. As I said, it's a big, important factor for the rural economy. Dennis was talking about that. Here it's just giving you a very messy scatter diagram about the percentage of household income represented from poultry, in this case from Vietnam. And you can see at the, if I don't know if I can operate this thing, I'll probably blind myself. At no, I cannot operate that thing. But at the far left-hand corner, which is the poorest populations, you're seeing that as much as 30% of those households' income is coming from poultry production, and the average is coming in about 10-57% for in the case of Vietnam. Taking that away has a real serious impact for those households, and it's something that really when you try and design, and I think Dennis was speaking to that, a policy to constrain the propagation of the disease, you have to take that into account. And the Vietnamese have actually been very relatively successful in that. They've put into a place where they offer sufficient returns to... Sorry. I put it here. No, I'm just... It's me. I didn't push the button. Okay, great. Thanks. They offer sufficient money for a farmer who declares that his flock has been infected, that it's economically attractive for him to do so, and they've managed to get that sufficiently close that it's not so attractive that he says, my healthy flock is has bird flu, come kill it and give me all the money. So it's a delicate balance, and ultimately, I think Dennis has got the point exactly right, is if this is an incubator for future diseases, then we've got to try and see what we can do to provide people with the private incentives so that they move on to a different activity. A very difficult task, and I certainly don't know the answer to that, but I think we're on the right track. One of the thought experiments that we did at the bank was, well, what happens as a first step if bird-to-bird flu becomes endemic throughout the world? And that's a real probability given the flight patterns that we've seen. And what we see here is the relative impact in terms of percentage GDP is small. We're talking about 0.6, 0.7% in the most deeply affected regions. That's something that, frankly, in our estimates of growth rates for different countries, just gets lost in the noise. It's not something you're going to see. You can see for the U.S. Or high-income countries, among which the United States, it really is the equivalent of an extra day off in a year because a holiday occurs on the weekend instead of the course of the year. So it's really not an important effect. But it's important for the individuals. So let's go to an eventual human pandemic. I think we made the point already that it's certainly not clear that H5N1 is going to be a pandemic. It's certainly not clear what its nature will be, how severe it might be. But it is pretty clear that there will be a new pandemic at some time, and that it might be mild, it might be moderate, or it might be severe. So really that's the way we've gone to look at it and say, okay, this is not avian influenza we're analyzing. We're just analyzing some sort of pandemic and what might its effects be going forward. In doing that, one of the sort of the first things we need to do is, well, what happens normally? What happens every year? And that was a very striking result for me, is that actually the flu is the third most deadly infectious disease in any given year operating in the world. And that's right here. So 1.2 million people, according to this estimate, die of the flu in the world every year. Now, this is not a very hard number. Some people say it's 500,000 people. Some say 1.5 million. So there's some uncertainty over it. But it's important to recognize that, gee, that's more than malaria. That's more than half of the number of people who die of tuberculosis. And it's more than a third of the people who die from AIDS. So actually, the flu is a big killer already. And it's not on our radar screen largely because it's banal, it's something very natural, and it affects older people who are already very sick from something else and it's killing them. So, but it's there, it's very real. Now, the next thing is, well, what are we talking about when we're talking about a pandemic? Well, a mild pandemic, estimates of the epidemiologists say that would bring that total up to about 7 million. A really serious pandemic could bring it up to 360 million. I think the scenarios that we've been talking about are more along the line of a moderate influenza of about 14 million deaths worldwide and a serious pandemic of about 70 million people worldwide. So compared with those numbers, even summed up, any of those are very serious consequences from a human perspective, and I think that's something for us as economists, and I think Donald made that point right on first. You know, the number one problem here is the human and the health implications of a pandemic, and the economic costs are relatively small. But because I don't have much to say about the human costs, I will stick to the economics. What's been happening for avian influenza? And here I just give a chart, the number of reported deaths, and I emphasize reported deaths because exactly as Donald said, you know, we say it's got a 50% attack rate or 50% mortality rate, but what do we know? And if you look at the reporting, the deaths to reporting ratios for avian influenza so far, you'll see that they're very varied. Some countries are reporting a 30% death rate. Some countries are reporting almost 100% death rate. And that really goes to this reporting issue. Are we getting all of the cases that do not result in death reported? And frankly, the answer is clearly no. So we don't really know how deadly this thing is. The other thing that's important in this graph is to look at Vietnam, which is the orange bars here, and you can see very important concentration of deaths in Vietnam in 2003-2004. But basically that process of culling and a very proactive both animal health and human health reaction to that has eliminated the number of cases in 2006 so far this year. That's a very positive story. It does suggest that it is possible to get in there and with the right combination of efforts on the private individual side but also on the public side, we can reduce the likelihood, because that's what we're talking about, reducing the likelihood of a mutation to a disease that is a pandemic. Final thing I'd like to point out here is we're talking sort of some 50 deaths worldwide so far this year from avian influenza. Compare that to the 1.2 million and recognize that this is really small potatoes at this stage. The problem is if we go beyond that. So what are the impacts of a human pandemic flu? Well, this we've talked already about the McKibben and Sidorenko model, the Lowy Institute. These are the results coming from it. And you can see, excuse me, I'll just put that down. We can see that the impacts that they're estimating can be very large, and there's a great deal of variation across regions. They're saying for the world as a whole, it could be as much as 4.7% of GDP. That would constitute a global recession by our measure. A mild scenario is going to be less than 1%, a moderate scenario about 2%, with considerable variation. I think we've already talked about some of the peculiarities of the way that they've gone about estimating, and I think that their approach is as good as any, and it's instructive. What's really instructive in these models is to look at the channels, the transmission channels that are being presented, and what they tell us. And if you don't believe that that transmission channel is as big or as important as it is, then you can scale back these results, because all of these are ultimately guesstimates, hopefully educated guesstimates, but they're really trying to give us a sense of the orders of magnitude that might be involved. We read this report with a great deal of interest at the bank, and as I said, we were uncertain about some of the precise numbers that they did. So what we did, but what we liked very much in what they did, was that they made an effort to take into account the relative strength of the healthcare systems in different countries and in different regions in the world, as well as population density, which is going to be an important parameter in spreading the disease, and finally, also in terms of the transportation network, so how easily people can move around, and to get a more varied estimate of the mortality rates that you could expect in different countries and different regions. So what we did is we took that basic notion at the bank as a starting point, and we said, okay, assuming these mortality rates, what's going to happen? And I've spread that out here, and I've tried to break down our estimates for the various regions that we look at the World Bank into the straight-up cost, because the workers are no longer there to work, what that's going to have. You can see that's about 0.5% of GDP. That's relatively unimportant. The impact of people being sick and people being absent in order to care for the people that are sick, that's even bigger than the actual cost in terms of the people dying in this, which is a very large shock. This is a 70 million deaths shock. But then it's the behavioral component to it, and that's what's dominant in it. And what we assumed here was essentially looking at the SARS epidemic, what happened, how people reacted in that situation. We said basically we're going to have a globally a 20% cut in air travel. We assume that in the thought experiment, that's a sort of a 40 or 50% cut in air travel to infected regions during the course of the epidemic. And that annualized over the year, that amounts to about 20%. And a more or less equivalent cut in terms of tourism, in terms of other mass transportation, in terms of restaurant and other entertainment-like activities. And what we get are very, very large numbers. And obviously the number that we put in there, that 20%, is relatively arbitrary. It could be smaller, it could be large, but what we're taking away from this is the most important fact is going to be the endogenous individual reaction to the disease. And for governments, the obvious policy response is that's the one thing they have some control over. They can't really determine the nature of the disease that is going to eventually come, but they can attempt to minimize that component, and that's really where the focus should lie. I don't have a slide, and I know I'm out of time, but I just wanted to speak to one issue which we've been talking about, and that is the transmission around the globe of the pandemic. We've done a lot of work on this, and it's not ready for prime time at this stage. But essentially, if we look at past pandemics, they went global relatively rapidly. It took about half a year to go from the place where it occurred initially to get around the whole world. And the one that we have sort of the best data about that process is the pandemic in 1968-1969. What our modelers have done has said, well, okay, that occurred basically through air travel, and you can actually see, you know, a sick person getting on a plane, arriving in a new city and infecting that city. And they've modeled that process at the individual level. And they said, okay, and that works pretty well. You can actually reproduce the pattern of the epidemic. And they said, now what happens if we have today's world of air travel? Well, something that took almost 6 months to propagate around the whole world gets around the whole world within 30 to 60 days now. And the reality is we just don't have the science to identify the disease, create a vaccine, and give everybody a vaccine in that kind of time. And so we're not in a position to prevent at this time with the state of science that we have to prevent the disease, or at least that's our appreciation at this point in time. The natural question says, well, can you quarantine it? Well, I think we've already alluded to the fact that one of the problems is that you are spreading the disease before you're symptomatic, so it's very difficult to identify people. So the thought experiment here is, well, okay, people that want to travel have to go into quarantine for 10 days before they travel. And that way, we know that they don't have it when they go. Think about that just a little bit. You know the lines at Dulles Airport already. obviously, that's going to have a very huge impact on the amount of travel. Our estimates using these models preliminarily suggest that you have to reduce the probability of a sick person traveling by 90% in order to slow the disease's propagation around the world sufficiently to allow a vaccine to be introduced somewhere in the midpoint of the epidemic. So it's not that it's impossible, and we're looking at and trying to see about it, but the answer doesn't appear at this moment to lie there. Anyway, thank you very much for your patience, and I guess I pass it off to my colleague from the fund.
See if I guess right. Yes, there we are. In the end, what can I say? Most of the things have already been covered, and from our point of view with the fund, we basically have no disagreements with what anyone says. We've looked at this, and we have essentially the same point of view. But I want to go over some things from a fund perspective. The way we look at things and what we're doing is very much focused on building awareness, understanding policy responses both now and during a pandemic, and transmitting that to all of our members, particularly in the areas of macroeconomics and finance. And we at the fund are very actively engaged in talking to all of our members on this. Together with a colleague, David Holscher, I am putting on seminars around the world for every central bank that belongs to the fund, every serious large market regulator. And we have one-day seminars which bring people together who are not very familiar with those who are familiar with the disease, World Health Organization experts, with central banks and financial regulators, which have done extensive work already in preparation, business continuity planning, et cetera, and also with private financial institutions which are doing the same thing. Among these are Don's group, which has an amazingly widespread and well-advanced business continuity effort, and they're far from alone. So let me summarize things a little bit from our perspective, and I think we can zip through most of these slides fairly quickly. We've already hit the four main points. What's the economic impact depend on? How many people get sick? How many people die? How long it lasts? How many waves? And as we just heard from the World Bank, behavior, behavior, behavior is everything. From an economic point of view, the single driver that we see is absenteeism. Absenteeism from the workforce and absenteeism from the marketplace, both supply and demand. Disruptions can be very widespread and hit some basic systems which we all depend on. Now, what do we see on the supply side? It's the same story that you've heard. I would just emphasize one thing, because we've been talking quite a bit with private sector firms, we've been talking with governments about what they expect. And one of the things is clear is that people may stay away not just because they're sick, but also because their families are sick, because schools may be closed and they have to take care of families, and they simply are afraid to go to work. Who wants to go into the metro or the tube or the subway or the T during the middle of an episode? And I think this is we think it's a big difference with 1918. There are more social safety nets now which allow people to stay away than there were almost 100 years ago. We're very concerned about networks, transport, utilities, and as I'll talk, the payment system, and absolutely certainly the IT backbone is going to get very stretched, and it's something which has received relatively little careful attention from what we understand so far. Trade may be important. The demand side, as I said, absenteeism will lead to reduced consumption. People aren't going to travel. They're not going to go on vacations. They're not going to go to restaurants, cinemas, etc. Since they don't want to go to stores, purchases of durables are going to plummet during the wave or each wave. And we would expect significant amounts of investment to be postponed. Not pulled, postponed. Now, what I'm giving a picture of is a very rapid, very severe decline for a brief period of time in economic activity. That's sort of how we see it. We see a sharp down followed by a rapid recovery. The presentations that we've seen so far are sort of on aggregate GDP in different places over a year. They're broadly in line with what we think. But what we're focusing on in our discussions very much is what happens over a year is very different than what happens over 2 months, 1 month, or one quarter. And what governments need to be prepared for is that the collateral damage from the sharp down be minimized so that the recovery, which would normally be expected, can occur. We've heard all of this already. I can go through it. There hasn't been much of an empirical impact from SARS or previous pandemics. But as I've said, this isn't 1918, and a flu pandemic is certainly not SARS. I think it was mentioned before, we have a different economic system, the just-in-time inventory, the dependence on systems, both national and global, are extremely important, and these supply chain vulnerabilities, we're not sure to what degree they will affect things. Now, we at the fund are not really focused on the numbers and trying to come up with an estimate of whether over a year things will under a severe case go down by 3% or 2.5% or 5%, or whether in a quarter they'll go down by 6% or 10% or 15%. There are just too many uncertainties. Instead, we're showing our members there's a range of estimates. Here are the dangers. We've talked about the Canadians. We've talked about McKibben already. Others have. There's one other that hasn't come up. Just the end of last week, the European Commission published a model quite similar in spirit and taking some assumptions from Dennis's CBO model, comes up with broadly similar results between 1.6 and 4%, depending on what you assume about the severity of the disease and what you assume about the behavioral, the fear factors. Financial markets, the other, Don, too, has talked a little bit about this. This is, for the fund, a major area of concern. And there are two issues, one, asset prices, and the other, operational risk. What we see happening to asset markets is similar to what we heard from Don. Given all the hype, we would think that the first sign of easy human-to-human transmission, the first sign that WHO has moved up its threat level from 3 to 4, is going to instantly lead to some spike in what we call risk aversion. There'll be a flight to low-risk assets. There'll be a rise in credit spreads. Equities in general will be hit, particularly airlines, and probably the reverse for some pharmaceutical companies like Roche. And there may be a fall in commodity prices. That's less clear. Demand would be down, but there may be supply disruptions, and we're a little hesitant to make a call on which direction that might go. I went the wrong way. At the country level, we would see those which have relatively weak fiscal positions, those where, at least until recently, asset price valuations had run up the most, those dependent on commodity or service exports, as the most exposed to the potential for a large-scale reversal in capital flows and a more severe financial impact on their economies. Financial institutions, clearly things like institutions like insurance companies will be under pressure, but to the extent that there's a sharp, albeit temporary, spike in risk aversion, that could put the balance sheet of a number of financial institutions, think hedge funds, if you will, if not large integrated financial institutions, under some stress. For some pension funds and insurance companies, there may be at least temporarily excesses versus prudential limits, things that policymakers will have to consider. And it's very important that these issues be considered now, how they would respond rather than waiting and not being prepared for any of these things. Again, just like the economic side, we would see the market price effects is probably temporary. But even temporary sharp adjustments can lead to collateral damage, which is why we think it's important to work on preparation. On the operational side, things would be much worse for the economy and financial markets if institutions that deliver financial services were in trouble. Think the payment system most of all. There could be problems due to absenteeism in major banks, financial market institutions, not just the traders, but also and asset managers, but also the exchanges. And if these were to occur on a wide-scale spread, it could cause serious consequences, what I would call collateral damage. The financial institutions, it's a human capital business together with computers and networks. High absenteeism leaves them very exposed, which is why virtually all of the major financial institutions globally have major efforts to consider how they're going to handle this, how they can, what businesses can be temporarily shut, which have to remain open, how you do trading, settlements, clearing, these types of technical things on a remote basis, often from home. This is different than other episodes where you'd want to move everyone to a different location. The focus is primarily on working from home, which raises the telecoms networks problem big time and is something, as I said, where more attention from the public sector now is clearly going to be needed. Like all networks, the financial institutions are dependent on each other. If you're prepared but your counterparties are not, you're in trouble too. We are anticipating on the consumer side there'll be increased demand for cash, short-term credit. People will be using internet banking, electronic retail payments, and both central banks and financial institutions need to think how these systems will work, how the cash, extra cash, will be delivered, again, in the context of disruptions potentially in the transportation system. On the policy side, what we see as important is a flexible response. There is going to be an increased demand for liquidity, both for cash and non-cash, and it's highly likely that what central banks will have to do is to meet that demand for liquidity and worry about sopping it up and worrying about inflation after the wave is gone. Coordination internally is key, which is why in this country, in UK, in Hong Kong, in Australia, a number of other places within the EU, there is a lot of coordination and groups being formed involving the private sector, the public sector, and their interaction in the financial area to make sure that others know what others are doing, that the regulators understand what problems might emerge. Regulators, of course, in most places are not showing their hand. We will do this, we will do that. But encouraging the financial institutions to come to them with the types of issues which will have to be considered and discuss how both sides can be prepared. Now, again, I conclude just by saying we would expect that the effects will be temporary. And the recovery will depend on confidence, will recovery in asset prices. And these things will in turn be dependent on minimizing the disruptions which come inevitably during the wave of an epidemic. And for these reasons, good preparation and strong policy response will contribute to generating confidence in the population and minimize the impact. Thank you very much.
We have time for just a few questions. I just want to mention there have been a number of references to the Lowy Institute analysis, and that was done on February of 06. The title of the report is Global Macroeconomic Consequences of Pandemic Influenza. And one of the lead author is Warwick McKibben, McKibbin. Okay, let's have a few questions. Let me just tell you that we're going to have to get out of this room very, very quickly because there's another event. Yes? The other event was canceled. Okay, we have a little bit of flexibility. Questions? Marty.
Marty Apple again. Since you're all economists, you're really mathematicians about behavior. And the biggest part of behavior, I'm just looking at a scenario in which, even in the best case, 1.5 million or 2 million children in the United States, elementary and middle school children, die in 3 weeks. And I'm not expecting people to rebound from that like you are. I've worked on an oncology ward for many years, and I've seen that even with well-prepared families, the loss of a child is a devastating event for many, many years. in their behavior and their capacity to rebound and to be productive people again. So I'm really at a loss to believe that the numbers are going to work out as easily as you do.
I don't work in an, I haven't worked in an oncology ward, but I did live day to day through the process of SARS, and I would certainly say, and I think many others have said, that the issues of measuring the economics is only part of it. But it does, there are, and when one uses, the talk of rebound is essentially using the SARS episode as an example, which was tended to be quite limited, right? And so essentially fear was the biggest factor, not reality. And the problem one associates with 1.5 million deaths is that there is a reality that substantiates that fear that has a much more lasting effect. And the way that's in most economic models is through a more permanent reduction in productivity associated with those affected from it. So you can factor it in. But certainly, I mean, just at a very personal level, right, one of the things that happened with many people that I know from SARS is their many life decisions changed. What were they doing? Are they happy with what they were doing? That had nothing to do with not going to the movies, but had much to do with a much real assessment of what was important in their lives and what they were doing to meet those goals.
Hi, I'm Josh Albert. And Mr. Hanna said something about how there's not really a question anymore of if so much as when. And you mentioned that the focus now needs to be on sort of containing and preparing to respond to that. And there's been a lot of conversation about government policy. But I'm kind of wondering, what are the kinds of things that we would want to see now in the private sector and in sort of industry, especially sort of in a globalized economy, that might help us in responding or limit the effects of a pandemic? And this is kind of directed to whoever might be able to answer it.
Well, the types of things which the private sector is doing falls generally in what's called business continuity planning. And it's multifaceted, but basically what corporates are doing, whether in the manufacturing sector, the financial sector, services, is trying to think through in advance what could happen, what type of absenteeism might I have under different scenarios, what are my succession plans, how do I inform my employees of various things, how do I minimize the health disruptions to my employees. There's a whole cottage industry of in that area with preparations for on-the-job health minimization. I didn't know it, but I've been told repeatedly by various experts, you can reduce the probability of catching the disease by about a third by simple, easy, low-cost, good human hygiene. For instance, I learned you don't cough or sneeze like that. It's not like this. It's into your elbow. Things like this. The hand washing, the rate of return in terms of disease from having the right hand washing equipment is extremely high. The succession plans when key personnel are out is very important. Deciding on which parts of the supply chain, if you're in the manufacturing business, what you have to supply, what you should inventory, what size teams are needed, is something which corporations around the world are thinking about and working on. There are tabletop exercises that people are doing where they get their executives together, they get others together, sit around the table for a day, and just go through, here's the news, how do we react, and sort of practice to the best you can how you'll do things. These are low-cost, sensible things to do, to think in advance how your business is effective and how you can plan for it. And we think that's a wise investment. whether it's the financial sector or the manufacturing sector or transport or communications.
If I could pick up, however, on your opening remark, which had to do with the not if but when. To be very clear, this isn't about if and when of H5N1. It's if and when of an emergent pathogen. H5N1 may be it, but it very well may not be. And I would think from a business perspective, one of the things we have seen over the last 20 years is a sort of almost an acceleration in the frequency of new emergent pathogens. Part of that has to do with our ability to detect them more, but there is, and I tried to make the point, what we're looking at are age-old traditions of putting animals and people in close proximity to one another. And that is creating an extraordinarily risky situation. These viruses or pathogens, rule number one, and I have to say, exempt myself from, and this isn't a question of social distancing, I'm not an economist, I am an infectious disease specialist. But rule number one in a potential pandemic agent is that it has to be a novel virus or a novel pathogen. The place where we find novel organisms is in other animals. And what we are seeing, partly driven to dramatic increases in human population and the food sources that are required to supplement those populations, is a dramatic increase in the number of people and animals interacting. The probability of a virus jumping from an animal to a human is no different than it's been, but the frequency with which it's happening because of the numbers of encounter has gone up dramatically. And so from a business perspective, I would say one of the things we have to be asking ourselves beyond this immediate sort of emergency is whether or not we have to take a different view of business community's vulnerability to repeated cycles of pending threats that are not inevitable. That 30 to 40 year cycle that we've seen historically is not a God-given. This has to do with new pathogens interacting with people. There are steps. This issue about personal hygiene can be extended to issues of biosecurity and how people and animals interact and how that rearing happens. So I would say one of the issues for business to consider is whether or not they need to be looking at new roles or new relationships with the animal husbandry industry that's out there. And to the extent it works to their own long-term advantage, to be making investments or to partnering in such a way that you can transform traditional animal rearing practices into more biosecure rearing practices that still allow people to get access to the necessary protein as well as enjoy the economic benefits.
Joe Dudley, SAIC. I think the question of baseline numbers, I mean, models are only as good as the data on which they are predicated. And I'm going to pick on Andrew because he cited some health data and some poultry industry data that I think are good examples. You cited a number of 200 million birds. From the poultry industry side. That number first floated in about May or June of 2004 and has now been recycled. So now 2 years later, 2 billion more birds later, we still see the 200 million birds number coming up in this context. This concerns me. Also, with regards to the AIDS mortality, I remember these numbers from when I was a AAAS fellow at USAID in 1999. 2.9 million deaths from AIDS, 2.0 million deaths from tuberculosis, 1.0 million deaths from malaria. Now, people who die from AIDS don't die from AIDS. In most of the world, they die from malaria or tuberculosis. So if you add up the total world mortality from tuberculosis and AIDS. It's 100,000 people more than the total of AIDS people. So, okay, so non-AIDS mortality from malaria and tuberculosis is 100,000 people a year worldwide. That doesn't work. So are these additive numbers? Well, the malaria and tuberculosis mortality from AIDS isn't counted. And that these and the problem, you know, so the numbers, we need to know what the numbers are, and we need to look very, very closely at what those numbers are, where they came from, and how long they've been recycled in building these models, because at the end of the day, the small errors that come from these foundational data points lead to huge impacts once the following assumptions have been loaded on.
Any more questions? One last question right here.
I'm Jeffrey Milstein. I'd like to ask a macroeconomic question dealing with financial markets. One of the other things that people say when, not if, is some massive readjustment to the value of the dollar due to the trade deficit, the balance of payments deficit, the budget deficits, etc. And obviously this has to do with primarily the Asian central banks' willingness to buy U.S. Treasury bonds and bills and invest in U.S. private companies. But again, many people have speculated it's a matter of when and not if there's some massive readjustment. And we've been talking about AIDS as something that will be when and not if. I'm sorry, pandemic, flu, or some other new pandemic due to some new pathogen being when, if not if. Could a new pandemic be basically the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of the financial markets? Do we have the possibility here of a perfect storm?
Look, the model that tries to answer that question, the issue on, first of all, on the issue of the dollar, okay, the fundamental question is an imbalance between savings and investment in the United States and savings and investment in the rest of the world. The perpetuation of the situation has something to do with Asian central banks, but that's relatively second order. The question of support then for the dollar going forward is an issue that surrounds returns to U.S. assets relative to other assets in the world, and the level of demand, right, in the United States, as that would affect investment and savings relative to the rest of the world. Okay, so the question of what would happen from a flu pandemic would depend on what it would do to interest rates. Leave aside for a question panic, okay? I'll get to that in just a second. But the issue would then arise of what you did to demand in the United States relative to the rest of the world. Would that tend to increase or decrease the current account deficit? Right? And what would happen to interest rates in the United States relative to interest rates elsewhere? Would that tend to increase or not the demand for the short-term capital flows arguments? Okay. Unless one, I would take the view that for any given level of mortality that you're likely to have a better health response in the U.S. than most of the rest of the world, right? And that the services of tourism and transportation, et cetera, while they are large, are not that much larger than alternative sources, i.e. Japan or Europe, where we've got, and certainly they're somewhat larger than in Asia, but not in a lot of the, well, leave that aside, that the effect, the economic effect that would come from that reduction in demand is relatively smaller, so that you are left in an environment in which the macroeconomic effect, relative demand in the U.S. is better served in this environment than the latter. That would tend to mitigate against an unraveling of the imbalance, in fact, would tend to exacerbate it. That the same on the interest rate effect, the interest rate effects, again, it depends on how central banks respond and whether we have this inflationary environment or deflationary environment. Yeah, but it's probably the case that the interest rate adjustments, again, associated with risk, if those are related in any way to mortality, that the long-term interest rates would adjust less in the U.S. because the mortality incidence is probably smaller in effect. And that, too, would tend to actually support that, would mean that capital would tend to be flowing in, not out, and that that would, again, lead to a situation in which you don't unwind the global imbalance. So in that sense, a perfect storm that leads to an unwinding of the U.S. dollar is probably not what you could expect if you had a more severe case. If we have a mild case, then we get into the risk. If we're dominated essentially by a rise in risk premia, right, that's temporary, there is a potential for that, for the situation to shift. But I don't, that's really a question of, do we know something about what drives risk premia, and is it risk premia that are at the elements of the picture that holds the dollar up in the current environment? Anyway, Charles?
I would second everything that Don says on this issue. I wouldn't think that a pandemic would be an event which increases the probability of a what's sometimes called a disorderly unwinding of the imbalances, either in the short term or in the longer term.
If I could just weigh in on that as well. I think it's important to be careful in using the not if but when framework to be clear about what it is we're talking about. So on the flu side, I think there's universal, I have not yet been able to find anyone in the world who claims there'll never be another flu pandemic, right? So I think there is, 100% consensus that it's a, when, not if, with the uncertainty around the timing, and then obviously uncertainty about severity, as we've talked about. On, the dollar, the current account imbalances, the global imbalances, there's obviously a strong belief that is, I think, very broadly shared that the United States can't run a current account imbalance of 7% of GDP indefinitely because that just doesn't work. So there's clearly a consensus that eventually that will adjust back. But there isn't a consensus, I don't think, that that has to happen through something that's disorderly. Right? There's some probability associated with the possibility that it would be disorderly. But the when, not if, in that context really applies to the fact that eventually we'll get back to balance. And could get there gradually, some probability possibly small that we get there disorderly.
All right. I'd like to thank all of our speakers. Those are superb presentations and enormously interesting. Thank you. And thank you all for coming. We're going to have related sessions in the fall. Please leave your cards or a little slip of paper with your contact information outside. We'll make sure that you know of these sessions that will resume in the fall. Thank you.